Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside of the Cross podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Quint Kessick. Quint, it's been a couple months and a lot has unfolded. Most notably, you spent 2 weeks in Israel and a new world champion has been crowned as the United States Top Canada 9-8 in a controversial affair, which we will dive into. But before we do, happy summer. How's it going for you?
It's been an incredible summer, Terry, in that, you know, I look back, it's not even August 1st yet. I feel like it's been nonstop, but fun. You go back to June covering the Under Armour All-America game at Hopkins to see the, you know, those girls and those boys in a preview of what that class has to offer. Then shipping out to Denver to watch the World Series of Youth Lacrosse and just being blown away by the talent and energy of U13s, and to see that event grow, and then shipping out to Israel and, you know, the 46 nations and a trip, once in a lifetime trip. I hope the folks were able to read and look at some of the photos that I submitted, because we not only had a great time, but we got to see some fantastic lacrosse and establish connections and solidify relationships with people from all across the globe who love the sport. So that was memorable on many fronts.
It's an amazing preamble because, you know, one of the things that we'll eventually get to as we talk about this game, this gold medal game, as well as the legacy of the teams and players involved, as well as the legacy of the event, is a very important realization, which is the world championships are, with the exception of 2, 3, 4 teams, it's the culmination of the lacrosse playing experience for the other 42 teams' members. And it's more of a celebration, less of a competition, than I think folks who have never been to the event would realize. And that's the context in which this controversial 3-minute sequence ended the 80-minute game at roughly 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time 2 Sundays ago. So taking ourselves back to Netanya Stadium, and just for context, my viewing experience was about 2 hours delayed. I didn't know the results, and the game was being streamed on an iPad in the console of my Jeep as Josh Davey and I drove up to Lehigh to watch the NLF Club National Championships. But it was heightened drama, even in that suboptimal viewing experience. As you reflect on it about 10 days removed, what are your thoughts about the way that the last 3 minutes unfolded?
Well, it's unfortunate. You know, if you were watching our coverage, you saw from the first televised game that I was critical of the officiating and the head scorers table. And in that first televised game, if you remember, at the end of the first quarter, there was some confusion as to the clock. They put 20 minutes and 08 seconds on it to start the second quarter. They finished that quarter, then they took another break, and we're saying to ourselves, you know, what is going on here? You can't put extra time on the clock. It's either got to be the end of the first quarter, or we're starting the second quarter anew. So, you know, I took a lot of heat for my criticism of the officiating at that stage, at that juncture. The reality is, the officiating was pretty darn good in Blue Division throughout the tournament. You know, obviously, it's not the standard that we're used to covering high-end Division I NCAA lacrosse for some of these televised games out of the ACC, the Big Ten, the Big East, and these great conferences, especially in the NCAA tournament. So you got to lower your expectations a little. So it was pretty good for most of the way. Unfortunately, at the tournament's most critical juncture, it reared its ugly head again. And there's a couple reasons. There's a couple solutions, and I think FIL is very aware of where they've been inadequate in terms of having quality officials in the Blue Division. And then the support. You know, we take it for granted that the people at the head scorers table, the people running the clock, know the rules. You know, it's stop time. You know, in international rules are different collegiate rules. And so I think all of those potential those potential pitfalls came back to bite the event at the exact wrong time and overshadowed what was a wonderful week of competition.
So to set the table, the U.S. jumped out to a 2-0 lead in the first 7 minutes of the first quarter and went to commercial. And my thought at that point was the U.S. has been pretty close to dominating, yet I don't have a great feeling about how this game is going to unfold. And then Canada went on their run, and over the course of the next 20 minutes, established a 4-2 lead about midway through the second quarter. And that U.S. battled back, cut it to 4-4, and then Canada answered twice more and made it 6-4 at halftime. In both of those instances when Canada built a 2-goal lead, I essentially said to myself, I think they're going to win this game 13-5. I was so impressed by the way that the Canadian defense had settled down. I thought that the American defense was out of sorts. And then that third quarter, which they held the Canadians, I believe, either scoreless or 2-1 goal, and then ended the third quarter with an incredible sequence where they defended the Canadian offense for 5 minutes. Multiple Canadian midfield substitution lines came onto the field, and time expired. You saw the big fist bump by the guys that were involved. I believe Michael Earhart was involved in that situation. It was interesting how, you know, that momentum was quickly countered by the Canadians. They scored early in the third period to go up 7-6. The U.S. answered, and then Canada, with about 5 minutes left to play, scored to go up 8-7, won the subsequent faceoff, and at that point, it was a pretty likely outcome that they were going to be able, the Maple Leafs were going to be able to kill the clock and bring home their second gold medal in as many tries. They're called for being offsides. There still hasn't been clear video evidence that they were definitively not offsides. However, everything that I've seen suggests pretty clearly that that call was made in error, and as a result, the U.S. were given the ball in error. They scored to make it 8-8. They won the subsequent faceoff, and then they held to take the final shot. They managed to take, I believe, by my calculation, 4 shots in the last 21 seconds, all of them resulting in subsequent end line restarts, and then the final end line restart resulting in a Tom Schreiber goal with 1 second remaining to give the U.S. the 9-8 victory and the gold medal. Those two, you know, relatively controversial situations. Number one, the offsides awarding of the ball to the U.S., and then number two, whether or not the clock management at the end of the game was appropriate and accurate relative to how long the ball was in play. Those are going to be situations that'll never be fully clarified in at least many people's minds. But for you, what does it mean for the legacy of this U.S. victory? Do you find it to be hollow?
Slightly, yes. I do. You know, I think they were two evenly matched teams. The game could have gone either way. But when Canada wins that face-off with a 1-goal lead and 4 minutes to go, I don't know what the stats would say, Terry. You're more, but in terms of win probability, ball and a 1-goal lead with 4 minutes to go and international rules, I would give them an 85% chance to win that game. Change of possession flips that. You know, it decreases that down to maybe in the 60% range to win that game. So that offsides call, and they were not offsides. I could clearly see they had 4 back. They had not had an extra man on the field. It was just an error. I agree with the FIL statement and the way they handled it. It's an unfortunate error that really opened the door for the U.S., and you have to give the Stars and Stripes credit for the way they capitalized on it. And they made the remaining plays, because one more mistake, you know, a turnover, a bad shot that Dylan was able to save instead of going wide, would have been the difference in the game. But, you know, they were given the opportunity, and they capitalized and won the game. Unfortunately, you know, I go back to that offsides call, which was an incorrect call. I saw it right away. They had 4 back. You know, the referee got confused because Graham Hasek is a winger on their faceoffs. Okay, so he's floating around the midfield line, and he backpedals to go back on defense. And I think the referee mistook him as being a defender who was offsides, as opposed to an LSM who was then stepping back over the midfield line to let somebody else either sub through the box or come over the midfield line. It was just a clear case of an official seeing body language. That guy must be offsides. He's backpedaling. And no, they still had plenty back, sir. So that was unfortunate. But again, I have to give the U.S. a lot of kudos for making all the available plays after that call was botched.
I'm glad that you evoked those two moments, so to speak, or points, because one of the things that the World Games presents is an opportunity to evaluate high-level play and players' legacies. And two guys whose esteem kind of really rose for me over the course of these games. You mentioned Graham Hossick. You know, for me, he played, I don't want to say Brody Merrill-esque, but within spitting distance. It was so, I mean, Graham Hossick has been preternaturally underrated the entirety of his lacrosse career, at least as it relates to field lacrosse, given, you know, where he played college lacrosse, his path to MLL, et cetera. And I think in these games, he showed a versatility, a motor, an energy level, a stamina level, and an ability to make plays that, you know, frankly exceeded my opinion of him, which was already, I thought, higher than a lot of folks' opinion of him. And then Ryan Brown, the U.S. national team attackman who scored the game-tying goal, I think it's pretty fair to call him the best shooter in lacrosse. And I think his contribution to this U.S. national team was existential. I don't think they win without him.
No. You know, you know, Kark was really big on the production of Rob Pennell and Jordan Wolf, and Canada did a great job in that regard. And Hossick, as you said, was unbelievable all tournament long. We were staying with the Canadians, and he is a bad dude, Terry. He's, you know, 6'2", 200 pound, chiseled, in tremendous shape. Will play indoor, outdoor, can play on a bed of glass if he had to, and that's the kind of type of guy you want on your team. Ryan Brown, I think that would be the one area where Canada may be second-guessing themselves in terms of how they covered him. You know, he was required to be face-guarded on some of those key defensive stands, and you just cannot leave him. You can't switch off of him. They probably should have put a shorty on him. He's no threat to dodge. You know, face-guard him with a shorty and then play a five-man package behind it may have been a better strategy. That's easy for me to say now, a couple weeks out from the event.
What are your memories or thoughts of Dylan Ward, given, you know, what the Team Canada goalie, you know, the platform that he kind of stepped into in 2014? Chris Anderson had been, you know, throughout the 2000s, the goaltending was a weak spot because, you know, Canadians predominantly play box lacrosse. Being a box lacrosse goalie is not the same as being a field lacrosse goalie. There's not much depth at that position. You have this guy who was an All-American in Virginia who becomes the goalie for the national team, and certainly subsequent to his death in the wake of the 2010 championships, it is a very substantial question in terms of both the inspiration, the on-field tactics that this team was going to pursue. Dylan Ward steps in, helps the team win a gold medal in 2014. He plays lacrosse all year round. He is not a full-time starter in MLL, and yet his performances at the highest stage playing in the Canadian for the Canadian national field team continues to inspire and impress me. And I'm curious, as a former goaltender, what your thoughts are on that.
Well, he and John Galloway both, you know, goalies have the rap of being a little quirky, but both he and John Galloway are about the most level-headed and normal people that you will ever meet. Just super guys, team guys. They study and work at their craft. And Dylan was fantastic. I think if there was one goal he would want back, it was actually the first goal of the game. He gave up some goals in the finals from yardage, which was atypical of what we'd seen from him throughout the tournament. But going into that final game, he was at 68%, and outstanding. And you know, I just think that he was great. He was a game changer for Team Canada, and he's got to be considered now at Denver with the Jack Kelly injury to be their starter for the stretch run here with week 14 and then the playoffs looming.
No question. A couple more players or position groups that I'm interested in your thoughts on. Certainly the faceoff X was going to be an interesting question given that the U.S. and Canada came in both with two faceoff guys, one an established veteran and another being a college player who was either a year or less than a year out of playing NCAA lacrosse. Ultimately, essentially, it was kind of a non-factor. Both teams ended up being 50%, but I'm interested in the overall dynamic, particularly what your reaction was to Jeff Snyder as a leader on that Canadian national team.
Well, invaluable. I mean, he represents the fabric of that team. I had a lot of time to talk with Jeff with Trevor Baptiste, with Trevor's parents, actually. And I think the big theme from the faceoff position was the inconsistency. The administration of the faceoff was a little bit out of the Wild West. And, you know, they've done such a marvelous job at Division I college at standardizing the faceoff, consistent week to week. The athletes and the coaches know what to coach. They know what to look for. They know the cues to take from the officials. There's good communication between draws, after draws. That's not the case in the World Games. And so it's the Wild West. No two faceoffs are identical. And it's a free-for-all, which can be very unpredictable for both athlete and fan.
One of the things that was really interesting to me was Jeremy Thompson, and then later, I believe, the Canadian faceoff guys looking at the official to see his cheeks inflate in order to blow the whistle. I found that to be really fascinating because it's not something you see at the college level.
No, and maybe we'll start to see it, but I've always coached my wing players to watch that referee because your eyes are faster. You know, light travels faster than sound, as we know from thunder and lightning storms. So you can get a half a step jump by watching that the whistle, the lips, and the cheeks of the official who's in charge, as opposed to waiting to hear it.
This episode of the Inside Lacrosse podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Head to ZipRecruiter.com/lacrosse to find out how to make hiring easier. This is a summer recap podcast, and that means that the recruiting season is all but over, which means that our recruiting database is the place to follow all the evaluations, commitments, and everything else that goes along with it in order to find the best next player for your favorite college team. And ZipRecruiter functions in much the same way. It is the best player, the best place to find a candidate for your open position. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply for your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so that you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. With results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest-rated hiring site in America. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter.com for free at this exclusive web address. That's ZipRecruiter.com/lacrosse. Once again, ZipRecruiter.com/LACROSSE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Wrapping up the World Games conversation, one of the things that was always going to be most significant for me was what the 2018 FIL World Championships meant in two ways for the growth of lacrosse internationally. Number one, it was the first premier event under Jim Scher's leadership as, I believe, the executive director of the FIL. And number two, it was going to be the most high-profile event in the wake of both the formalization of the FIL as well as the continued progress towards hopeful inclusion in the 2028 Olympic Games. Along the way, there will be steps such as IOC recognition, etc. One of the big things that came out of the Congress that happened before the event was the declaration that the 2022 World Championships, which will be held in Coquitlam, British Columbia, will only feature 30 teams. It'll be the first time that not every nation who's able to field a team will be allowed to be represented at the World Championships. But then also the fact that, I'll say it this way, number one, if you think all the way back to where we were coming away from the 2014 World Games, this event was supposed to take place in Manchester. The Iroquois had just proven their capacity to overcome their travel limitations and then be able to participate in the games after not having participated in 2010. And then fast forward to the fact that the games were in Israel, the Canadian national team had what is best summarized as a labor dispute that jeopardized their participation. And then at the 11th hour, literally at the 11th hour, the Iroquois national team once again ran into issues in terms of their capacity to travel internationally. the fact that everything happened more or less as it was supposed to, and the fact that, you know, the I guess administrative snafus had on or were on the field issues, to me represents progress, represents a source of I don't want to say hope because that's too strong of a word, but, you know, everything happened more or less the way it was supposed to, and I'm curious as to what your boots on the ground experience showed or told you about what can be expected to come as far as this world of international lacrosse is concerned.
Well, there are three things that stand out, I think. Number one, you know, getting everybody there wasn't easy. So when the Iroquois arrived, you know, at that 11th hour, there was a giant sigh of relief, and that was wonderful because they are the spirit of this event. They're beloved by the 45 other nations. You know, going for the Olympics were everywhere. You know, every discussion I had with Jim, with Steve Stenerson, with leaders from Latvia, Hong Kong, Australia, Scotland, England. You know, the Olympics is a big deal because fans need to understand that if lacrosse is accepted as an Olympic sport, how that will dramatically improve the funding for a place like England, okay, who's been kind of just floating in that 5 through 8 range now for the last 3 or 4 or 5 World Games. That will immediately, they can go to their government and say, hey, look, we're the 5th best team lacrosse in the world. Can we have $200,000 for a facility, for field rentals, for youth clinics? That money would be gigantic. And times that money to the Philippines, to Hong Kong, to Italy, to Latvia, and next thing you know, you're going to have significant growth. So that would be the most significant moment globally for lacrosse in our lifetimes. A couple things that come with that, though. You know, standards of eligibility. You know, when Philippines and Puerto Rico have such great showings with American-born collegiate players, you kind of shake your head like, well, that's a team of ringers. And then other nations stay true to, you know, passports, whether it's 19 out of 23 or 23 out of 23. So we've got to figure out to get this event to the Olympic standard how, from a passport standpoint, everybody's competing on equal ground. That would be, you know, one takeaway. Improve the officiating, improve the scores table. That's another takeaway. And then my last takeaway is, you know, this tournament is great. Obviously, U.S. and Canada stand out. Iroquois is a solid 3. 4 through 15 are where the parity is starting to emerge. And those are the fun games because they're pretty evenly matched teams in that 4 through 15 scope. When you get down in the high 20s to 45, the games aren't from where we're used to watching such high level ball in the U.S. that going there with a high expectation for what you're going to see, you're going to have your heart ripped out. But it's getting better, and so many teams are getting better. Just so you know, they're all getting better together. So it's hard for different nations to leapfrog each other. But so we're seeing overall improvement. The parity is right in that high middle spot between 5 and 15. Those are the good games. But anytime a USA or Canada plays one of those lower teams, it's been pretty ugly. So I'd like to see that improve. Now, when they talk about Olympics, they're talking about major rules changes. Okay, and that's why Jim has been involved in this. Where you're not going to see 10-on-10 lacrosse and 100, and, you know, you're not going to see a big field. You're going to see a shrunken down version, whether it's a 70-yard field, 6-on-6 or 7-on-7 like rugby sevens. Because the Olympic, they can't house 23 athletes. They can't travel 23 athletes. These lesser nations can't compete from spots 15 to 23 on their roster. But if it's 7-on-7, that should shrink the U.S. and Canada's dominance. Some of these other nations should be able to field more competitive teams. Get the game done in a two-hour window. Keep the ball moving. Bring the game back to its roots as the fastest sport on 2 feet. And I think you have a shot to be at least a demonstration sport in the Olympics that they're targeting. I think that's 2028.
It's certainly exciting, and I think you hit on all of the pertinent topics, particularly from a rules development standpoint, an eligibility standpoint, a competitive standpoint, and the timeline. And, you know, I feel personally invested or professionally invested in the sense that, you know, this is a story that I've been trying to tout for the last 18 months. And I think it's starting to bear fruit now. And I think it'll be exciting to continue.
Let me add something to that. Cause as an American, you know, we feel proud, you know, Anish Cotter, Kark and myself were walking around and all these teams knew who we were. So many of these young players in these countries are logging on the internet, and they're looking at the content at Inside Lacrosse. They're looking at these Ryan Brown when he posts a shooting video to YouTube, Greg Renly when he posts a video to YouTube for Facing Off. And we really are the shepherds of this game. And I felt such a warmth and such a sense of responsibility that we're the leaders in this game. And it was never more evident when you spend time with the Latvian team, as we did when we traveled to Jerusalem and spent the day with them, and Josai of Hong Kong and that group. And they're all looking for the U.S. to be leaders. And we just have to keep that in mind, whether it's after you graduate college, hey, take a month trip, go to Scotland, go to Australia, do some clinics. You can really use lacrosse to grow your global network. Okay, it's not just about doing a clinic in Austin, Texas and Charleston, South Carolina. There's major opportunities right now in this game globally for individuals, teams, and entities to grow and take a significant chunk of what's going to be an international pie.
Let us transition to the world of college lacrosse and whip around some of the more significant elements of the summer. Looking forward, last week the conversation started to bubble up, and I think we'll continue to see this over the course of the next 10 days. The NCAA will meet to discuss their biannual rules evaluation, and certainly it seems that at the top of the list will be a permanent shot clock. Quint, just briefly, your opinion on what course of action should be taken?
Well, I think we need it. I'm in favor of a 60, but there's a lot of people who would prefer a 90 second. We'll see how that goes. I spoke to Lars Tiffany, Virginia coach, who's in Israel coaching the Iroquois, and I recommend that he speak to guys like Jim Stagnita, Tony Seaman, Dave Cottle, who have experience at the pro game right now. They've been playing with it with a shot clock and a two-point arc for 18 years in Major League Lacrosse, and that's data, that's game flow, that's scenarios that this rules committee needs to be in touch with. So I recommend those gentlemen as being experts, more so than myself. They've coached it, they've lived it, they've seen it on both sides, and they're invaluable to making any kind of adjustments to the rules necessary.
And you mentioned Lars Tiffany. He is a member of that rules committee, and a lot to be discussed and decided. Do you think there's anything else that will rise to the level, or is there anything else? I mean, we've talked about things such as shrinking the substitution box back to the 10-yard size that it originally was, and other rules that I would talk about as being quote-unquote on the margins. The only other ones that I think legitimately would be more significant are ones that I don't find to be realistic in this rule cycle, such as a two-point arc or any other substantial change to the field alignment.
Now, the only one I'd like to see, obviously, shrink the substitution box, but then the timeouts. The way these coaches are given so many timeouts and so many stoppages to save possessions, robbing the game of spontaneous moments, robbing a defense of an opportunity to create a turnover and then some transition. So I would look to limit team timeouts, maybe subtract one per game, and next thing we can get our games in a two-hour window. That's a big deal right now for ESPN and programming. If we're going to see more and more games on college on TV, one of the appeals of softball is they can get those games done in 2 hours and get on to the next game, and that would be big if we could take our average playing time from 209, 210, somewhere in the less than 215, down right around the two-hour mark.
Moving on, the summertime always means coach movement, and we had more news last week as Colgate named Notre Dame assistant Matt Carweck as their new head coach, replacing Mike Murphy, who parted ways with the program in June. But among the head coaching changes at the Division I men's level, Lafayette hired Pat Myers first on June 4th to get the wheel spinning, as it is sometimes referred to. In addition to that, we saw Bellarmine hire Jim Mitchell on June 20th. Siena hired Liam Gleason on June 26th. Holy Cross elevated Peter Burke from interim head coach to head coach on June 29th. And then not a head coach position, but one that did provide some clarity on July 19th. Eric Saramet joined Rutgers staff as an assistant, kind of bringing some finality to his tenure at Air Force. Do any of those moves strike you as a needle mover in a way that some of the others don't?
No, I don't think so. I'm still waiting for what North Carolina to hire a defensive coordinator. Correct.
That's correct. North Carolina and Albany
and,
are
and, and now Air Force jobs. Has to hire a head coach.
That's right. Unless they choose to elevate Bill Wilson from interim head coach to full time head coach, which obviously is the choice the Holy Cross made with Peter Burke as well.
Yeah, those are the two that have my eye right now.
And then as far as player personnel movement is concerned, really there was one transfer that rose above the rest prominence-wise across the sport this summer, and that is T.D. Erland transferring from Albany to Yale, joining the national champions with 2 years of eligibility remaining.
Yeah, there'll be a handful of others that you'll have to keep your eye on when students enroll and start fall practices. Let me just say that. They're nothing in the scope of TD's move, but they could be significant down the road.
And the last bit of news from the Division I men's world, St. Bonaventure joined the MAC for their inaugural season in 2019. I'm working on a piece currently about the prospects of an additional lacrosse-only conference or a new lacrosse conference at the Division I men's level that hopefully we'll have out by, I don't know, let's say the end of the week. Depends on when you're listening to this. Quint, before we move along, you mentioned the Under Armour All-America game. It certainly sets the table for the 2018 recruiting analysis. Don't want to put you on a spot because I realize it was a month ago. Anything come to mind when you think back to that Under Armour All-America game that rises to the level of sharing in this summer roundup?
Oof, I don't have my notes. You know, I know the Hopkins fans were all over me in Israel, you know, what I think, but I thought Joey Epstein and Evan Zinn were very impressive, and I think they're two guys that the Blue Jays can plug in. I think Virginia's class overall was extremely strong, players everywhere. There were a couple other isolated guys who caught my eye, but, you know, skillful class, really big, strong defenders. You know, I love the kid Makar, you know, going to Maryland. Duke's got a primetime defender, might be able to start right away. And then obviously North Carolina should bring in one or two freshman starters in their top six defensive rotation, and they'll need it. Question is who's going to be their defensive coach. So good kids, enjoyed the week. You know, they get bigger, stronger, faster every year. They've all been put through the gauntlet now. By the time they're seniors in high school with this incredible recruiting workload that they have to go through to get to that point. So I think your guys do a great job. There's very few secrets out there nowadays because the kids are basically overexposed.
The summer recruiting circuit has come to an end. Make sure to check insidethelacrosse.com/recruiting as we will continue to circulate all the evaluations that we produced and unveil new features as we get ready for the annual recruiting issue, which will launch at early September. Last thing we're going to touch on, Quinn, before we let you get back to your break and vacation, the Dallas Rattlers are the number one seed in the MLL playoffs. The Chesapeake Bayhawks have clinched the number two seed with their 9-4 record. Denver, Atlanta, New York, and Charlotte are competing for the last two spots in the playoffs. Charlotte's season is complete. They are 7-7. The other three teams are 7-6. You're calling the MLL championship from Charleston, South Carolina. What do you got your eye on as we head into this, as you called it, stretch run of the MLL season?
You know, it typically I focus on what happens after July 4th as being meaningful. You know, early season rosters aren't solidified. The college talent hasn't assimilated themselves into the rosters. But this year with the World Games, it's even harder to figure out, you know, what a team's top 20 guys really look like. And there's been a lot of roster moves along the way. The reality is that Dallas, with a couple, just a handful of stars, you know, Jordan Wolf, they got John Galloway in the goal, but it's kind of a no-name bunch. They've managed to go 10-3, terrific home court advantage, playing indoors at the Star. They've capitalized on that. I've watched Chesapeake play. They play a more collegiate style, strong defense. They have just a wonderful chemistry. And then after that, it's kind of wide open. I can't remember a year where we've had, you know, four teams fighting four teams basically fighting for two spots in the playoffs. Obviously, Chesapeake hosts on August 11th. That's a Saturday in semifinals. Dallas will host the same day, and then we'll reconvene on August 18th. As you said, Charleston, South Carolina, if you're in the Carolinas, please come on down to that game. We got the Honors Award Banquet. on the Friday the 17th in downtown Charleston at a theater. There'll be all sorts of access opportunities there if you have a young fan or a young player. And I'm just excited to wrap up. It's great to be back, having broadcast the first 13 MLL championship games. It's great to be back for 2018.
Well, Quint, we appreciate your time as always on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. I think we did a decent job of rounding up the last 2 months since we last spoke.
We got Lake Placid kicking in later here in the first week of August, which is always a thrill for the old guys and the young guys. And that kind of after that, things settle down where MLLs really are only gig as the youngsters get ready for soccer or football season.
All right, well, that'll do it for this edition of the Inside Lacrosse podcast. If you like what you heard, head to Apple Podcasts, leave a rating and a review. Tell a friend, hit us up on Twitter. I'm at Terrence Voigt. He's at Q Kesnick, and we will be back at some point indetermined into the future.
Terry, the biggest thing about Israel, we taught Anish how to swim.
Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.